Behind the Knife, the surgery podcast, where we take a behind-the-scenes, intimate look at surgery from leaders in the field.
Okay, Behind the Knife here, back again at the Trauma Critical Care and Acute Care Surgery Conference, otherwise known as the Maddox Conference. This is the final day of the conference. We've had a fantastic time here. This has been one of I don't know about you, John, but this has been one of the best conferences I've ever attended.
Yeah, I definitely think so. And I think the reason for that is, you know, you have all these great surgeons and trauma surgeons that take all the data and they make the great interpretation without bogging us down with a lot of like science and math, things like that.
Yeah, it's a really solid curriculum. If you guys out there have never been to the conference, when you come to the conference, you get basically a textbook that the organizers have put together, and it's really well organized and a very disciplined conference. And I've taken away a lot of really practical information.
We also want to thank the East Trauma Cast too, and specifically Dr. Matthew Martin, one of our mentors, for helping us to get this all set up and inviting us down here.
So for the final day, today we're going to talk to Dr. Demetriadis about how to manage the open abdomen in the trauma setting, and then we're going to have another panel discussion. So to kick things off, here's our interview with Dr. Demetriadis.
All right, so we are finishing up our last day here in Las Vegas at the Trauma Critical Care and Acute Care Surgery Conference, the Maddox course, and we're very pleased to have Dr. Demetriadis with us here. Sir, if you don't mind telling the listeners out there, if you could just tell them your full name and where you're at right now.
Yes, Dimitrios Dimitriadis. I'm a professor of surgery at the University of Southern California and the director of the acute care surgery program at that university.
So one of the things, you've had some great talks here and some great panel sessions and everything. I'm just wondering if you could tell the listeners a little bit about kind of some high points or teaching points regarding the management of the patient with the open abdomen.
Yeah, there are two very strong indications for the open abdomen concept. The first one, of course, is the damage control procedures, and the second one is the treatment of intra-abdominal hypertension. Now, there is a third one emerging, which is the severe abdominal sepsis. There is good evidence coming out, class two or three, still no class one evidence, that the open abdomen with negative pressure therapy improves survival. The open abdomen treats definitively some major problems, but at the same time creates new problems. If you do not achieve definitive primary closure within 5 days, there is a significant increase of the risk of fistulas and other complications. So the secret is to try and achieve definitive closure within the first at least 5 days.
So before we get to how you manage the open abdomen, for you, what prompts you to leave somebody open in the first place?
Okay, these are the three indications I mentioned. Number one, damage control operations. You have catastrophic bleeding and you puck temporarily. You have to leave the abdomen open. If you do not leave it open, you close the skin, you are going to have an abdominal compartment syndrome. The second strong indication is the treatment of the abdominal compartment syndrome and intra-abdominal hypertension. And as I mentioned, the third one, which is not as strong as the other two, is severe intra-abdominal sepsis.
So let's talk a little bit about the technical tips. We have everybody, we've said this a lot of times, from medical students all the way up to attending surgeons. When you do an open abdomen, what do you use? What do you ask for? What are the different types of things if you don't have some of the fancier Apthera type devices? Walk us through that.
Okay, one important tip. If you leave the abdomen open because of damage control due to bleeding, it's important to use regular plastic material and labs, green towels, whatever you want, to close the abdomen. Do not apply negative pressure therapy. If you apply negative pressure therapy, any type of VAC or its modifications, the bleeding might become worse. So at least the first 24 hours, passive abdominal dressing. If you do not have this problem with bleeding, I think from day one you should use some sort of a negative pressure therapy. The negative pressure therapy dressing has many advantages. First, it removes much more effectively all the infected fluid from the abdomen, or the fluid which is loaded with toxins and bacteria and inflammatory substances. And thirdly, it maintains the abdominal wall domain. So it makes the approximation of the fascia and definitive closure much, much easier when you want to do that.
So getting back to a little bit about the management of the open abdomen itself, one of the biggest problems, as you just mentioned, was the loss of the domain. The fascia that goes in, the abdomen swells. There's some different devices. You've seen things, you know, sewing mesh to the fascial edges and cinching that closed, skin devices, towel clips, everything. What are some tips and tricks that you've learned through the years in terms of preventing that loss of domain, preventing the fascial retraction in those patients that you can't necessarily get them closed right away, but you still are trying to get there maybe in the first week or so?
Okay. So the first key secret, which probably is the most important, is to avoid excessive fluid resuscitation. And that's a common mistake. You give excessive fluids, the bowel becomes edematous, and you cannot close it later on. So that's a number one principle. Number two, you want to put some sort of a membrane between the bowel and the peritoneum, because after a few days, they'll stick together. And later on, when you try to mobilize the fascia, you have the bowel in the way. So you keep them separate. You put some sort of a membrane, one of the commercially available membranes. And the third one, you can use any of the available systems. It can be the negative pressure therapy, it can be the Velcro type things, sutures, whatever you want. Personally, I prefer and I only use negative pressure therapy.
So how do you decide when it's time to, when it's okay to close?
Okay, the patient will go to the operating room. We'll make sure that there is no residual infection or a disaster behind. And then I ask the anesthesiologist, what is the peak inspiratory pressure? So he'll tell me 28. I start putting interrupted sutures at the very top, a couple at the top, a couple at the bottom. And then I'll ask again the anesthesiologist, what's the peak inspiratory pressure? No change. I'll put another couple of sutures. I ask again. If the anesthesiologist tells me, you know, the peak inspiratory pressure increased to 35, I'll stop. So I close partially the upper and the lower part of the wound and leave the rest open. And I'll come back in 2 days' time and do exactly the same process.
Is there any role for any anti-adhesive barrier things that you can put in, Seprafilm or something like that, into the abdomen to try to get the bowel to kind of stick up against there, especially laterally as that retracts? Has that ever been looked at?
No. I don't think that it has any significant place in this situation. In fact, if you have an anastomosis and you put a Seprafilm around it, you put at risk this anastomosis. But definitely you need to use some sort of one of the transparent materials between the small bowel loops and the peritoneum.
So what do you do in this situation when you can't get the abdomen closed and it's been 10 days and you still can't?
Okay. So in this situation, you have to use biological material. You'll go in, you do component separation, and then use one of the biological materials available commercially. These biological meshes take infection much easier, and if they get infected, you do not have to remove them. You give antibiotics. If you have a synthetic mesh and they get infected, which is a real risk, you have to remove it.
Is there any of these patients that you've left open and you have to use biologics? You know, first off, how do they do typically, in the long term? And is there anything keys postoperatively that you can maybe do to help them along?
Okay, so I remember that if you do the appropriate careful resuscitation, not fluid overloading, if you use negative pressure therapy, about 95% of your patients will be closed primarily without having to use any meshes. But in 5%, you still have a problem. And in these cases, it's essential that you do good mobilization, component separation, use any of the available biological meshes, have in mind that in the long term, there is quite a high incidence of redundancy. Some of these meshes become redundant, some of them develop hernias. But that's the least price to pay for this condition.
So I read an editorial not too long ago that spoke about damage control in the open abdomen being probably the most overutilized and the most underutilized, maybe when it's appropriate. Yeah. So on both ends, your thoughts about that? And then can you talk briefly, and just again, you touched very briefly on it before, but some of the negative aspects. So people who think, like, you know, when you're a hammer, the world's a nail, so I'm just going to leave them open. And what are some of the downsides of potentially doing that?
Yeah, that's still, in my opinion, damage control operations, it's the surgical technique approach which saved more lives than any other surgical technique in the last 10, 15 years. We really saved a huge number of patients. I will never regret leaving the patient open temporarily and coming back the next day to close him. So I think if you do not have confidence, you do not have the experience in managing some difficult injuries, I would use damage control liberally. The common mistake in my mind is that you apply damage control too late. In other words, you try to stop them bleeding, you try, and instead of using early damage control, you wait until the patient is about to die, and then becomes hypothermic and acidotic and coagulopathic, and at that time you say, okay, I will do damage control. In my mind, an experienced surgeon will do damage control very early. He will assess the situation and will say, this is a difficult injury. I am going to do damage control. I am going to pack this liver. If the packing is effective, call it off.
What's your opinion of leaving the abdomen open for ischemic bowel, for, you know, the classic come back for a second look?
Yeah, I think it's an absolute must. In my opinion, it's a serious error to close the abdomen because you'll regret it. The next day, the patient has long grade fever and the white cell count is a little bit elevated, and then you start thinking, now, do we have more dead bowel behind? I wish I would left this abdomen open. So my recommendation and my practice, leave it open unless there is a very specific reason. The bowel is dead because of a strangulated hernia. But if it's an ischemic bowel because of mesenteric thrombosis, or any other systemic reason, I would definitely leave it open.
Sir, thank you very much for your time. You've been an integral part of this meeting for many years, we all know. Thinking back, do you have a specific, or what's been your favorite memory of all time from this meeting?
Well, it's every time it's a different experience. I've been coming to this meeting as a faculty for 20 years. It has become the number one trauma meeting in the world, the largest meeting, the most disciplined meeting. A lot of younger faculty saw their paces through this meeting and became national leaders. So I think it's the number one in the world.
Well, we appreciate you taking the time out to join us on Behind the Knife.
Okay, thank you very much. It's a pleasure.
All right, so we're rounding up the afternoon session here at the Acute Care Trauma Critical Care Conference 2016, joined by our guests right here. Guys, if you just kind of let the podcast listeners know who you're at and where you're from.
Sure. My name's Todd Maxson. I'm a pediatric surgeon, and I run the trauma program at the University of Arkansas.
And I'm Andrew Bernard. I'm the trauma medical director at the University of Kentucky in Lexington.
Andrew, we'll start with you, so since you got the mic in front of you there.
Thanks.
So, give the listeners who weren't lucky enough to be here a little bit of some highlights about, you know, you talked about multidisciplinary approach to pain control and all the other things. Just what are some of the highlights? What are some of the challenges? And where do you see the next things in terms of the horizon?
Well, we come from ground zero in the opioid abuse and overdose problem. So we know how pain control can be good and bad in Kentucky. So I was emphasizing in my presentation the role of non-opiate analgesia. The data will suggest that opiates are not the best option. They shouldn't be our go-to drugs. That in fact, Tylenol, paracetamol, and non-steroidals are very effective. We hear from our patients all the time, "Doc, that doesn't work for me." Well, the data suggests differently. We should be using Tylenol alone or in combination with non-steroidals a lot more often, and we should be using other non-opiate alternatives like alpha agonists, you know, clonidine, ketamine, maybe gabapentin. We should be thinking outside the opiate box. That was my main message.
Now, for all our listeners out there, we have med students to, you know, attending, you know, chairs of surgery. You mentioned a lot of things during your talk about certain pitfalls that, you know, providers will fall into, maybe misdosing medications. Can you maybe give us like a, you know, top three pitfalls people run into when they dose some medications? Maybe you're a new intern in an ICU and not sure how to do everything.
Yeah, number one is what I just said about opiates being the go-to. They shouldn't be the go-to. I would say number two being that if the pain control is inadequate, the answer is more opiate. It's probably not the answer. We know that with enough opiate, you could even develop opioid-induced hyperalgesia. We could be making them worse by escalating the dose. And we don't understand all the negative effects of opiates. And the last thing I'll say is again, just emphasizing the role of alternative therapies and how they can minimize the opioid amount that's required to get adequate analgesia in the patient. Those would be my three big messages.
So, Todd, same content. Any things that have worked for you or kind of pearls that you've run into in terms of pain control at your institution?
I think the key for us is to be preemptive. So I will say that in our elective surgery practice, even in our emergency surgery practice, we're very preemptive with regional anesthesia. So we'll block almost everything up front. We'll block again at the end. We bring in a multidisciplinary group of anesthesiologists, of pain management people afterwards. And I think because they're a little bit naive, the pediatric patient is somewhat naive to narcotic, we get a little bit less of the pushback of, "Doc, this doesn't work for me." But I think our key to success is to be preemptive with our regional anesthesia prior to operation.
Todd, you mentioned something really important, I think, right there, and that's the role that regional analgesia has. Mm-hmm. It definitely has a role, but I don't see it borne out completely in the literature yet. I'm thinking a student or resident, young faculty member out there that wanted to carve out their niche or a niche for themselves in academic surgery, it would be to partner with an anesthetist or pain management person at their place and do a series, just about anything you did right now and threw out there in a particular clinical realm, clinical problem, partnering with a pain management specialist would be novel and would get snapped up for publication right away, I think.
I think it'd be a great opportunity for young people to create a niche for themselves. I agree completely.
So Dr. Bernard, you know, one of the biggest things we struggle with as far as adequate pain control and analgesia is in patients with rib fractures. I don't know if you could just some tips and tricks that you found over the years that you found has worked both in young patients and in the, you know, the elderly, the 90-year-old that has multiple rib fractures.
Well, I'm on the board of EAST. Been an EAST member for a long time, and I preach the EAST guidelines. What I didn't have in my talk today are the EAST guidelines talking about rib fractures. Because as I was preparing for this talk, it was surprising to me how conflicting the evidence is on epidurals and rib fractures. There's data that says they're good. There's data that says maybe they don't make that big of a difference. And it's the more recent data that question the utility of epidurals. So we use them. We go by the four or more rib fractures and somebody 65 and older, you should get an epidural in place. But I think they're definitely alternatives. What I also didn't discuss today, but definitely has an emerging role, is good old-fashioned rib blocks done with liposomal bupivacaine. If we could break through the cost barrier there, we could get young house officers doing sequential rib blocks like we used to in the old days, yeah, and getting great durable pain control without using without using epidurals at all.
What about some patches? You have any experience with patches for the?
We've used them anecdotally. The data is not overwhelming on them, but I think that's another alternative. Slap a lidocaine patch over a patch of ribs on a patient. These old patients do not do well with impaired ventilation. These patients are becoming more and more common, more and more a big part of our practice. So they're driving the need. You know, necessity is the mother of invention here. So we're exploring all these possible options. It's like full contact martial arts. You're using all your faculties.
Any thoughts for either one of you about early rib fixation? I mean, I know, you can go walk down the vendor hall. I'm sure there's somebody that's down there kind of piping it. I know that where Matt works, he has one of the other people that really are a big promoter of that. But what are your thoughts about that?
Well, the good part for us in the pediatric world is that you put two pieces of rib in the same room, they're going to heal. So I think it rarely do we see multi-level segments, rarely do we see flail segments, and so physiologically just not as big a consequence for us.
It's growing. It took a big burst right off, then enthusiasm tempered a little bit, but now it's clearly on a climb that's going to continue. The technology's better. The ease of doing the fixations better and better. The recent paper from Denver giving us a nice, clear, succinct, easy to interpret protocol about who needs it and who doesn't. It is addressing that question mark that we've all had over our head about who's the right guy or girl to get rib fixation. So you're going to see it grow and grow and grow, and I think that's a good thing. It works.
So just to switch gears real quick, Dr. Maxson, you talked about pediatric resuscitation and blood transfusions in pediatrics. Now, this is a topic that I think even people who are very comfortable resuscitating adults, transfusing adults, and dealing with massive transfusion, a lot of blood loss in adults, still feel very uncomfortable. Some high points of your talk as far as your goals and your triggers for transfusion in children.
Yeah, sure. I think the biggest thing is the physiologic difference that you got to appreciate that kids have a higher sympathetic tone. And they have a more reactive media to the medium-sized vessels, and that by the time you see a hypotensive kid, you are so far behind the power curve, almost 35-40% down circulating blood volume. So in and of itself, hypotension or a dropping hematocrit is probably an indication to start transfusion and begin very quickly to think about a massive transfusion protocol. And one of the challenges we have at freestanding children's hospitals is that this happens very rarely. The hypotensive child from exsanguinated hemorrhage is a very rare event. And so I think we have to have more liberal triggers. I think we have to pull the trigger more frequently. We have to think about how to get plasma, because none of us have a high enough volume in the pediatric world to keep thawed plasma. We got to think of creative ways to get plasma to the patient so we don't get way behind on the blood product.
Yeah, that was actually going to lead into my next question. Is there, with the 1-to-1-to-1, in adults, is there a similar type of thing in kids? Have we studied that, or do we know?
It has not really been studied. The data out of the theater in Afghanistan and Iraq suggests it has mixed results, but suggests that 1-to-1-to-1 was not really beneficial in that group. But again, I think it's wrong to make a blanket statement that it always works or it never works. I think there are differences in the physiology, even within an age group, that are going to make it work or not work. And so I think it's incumbent upon us to get some biologic testing to figure out who that's going to benefit and who it's not going to benefit. Having said it, I think I still want to strive for a 1-to-1-to-1 ratio. I think our challenge is to get the plasma to the patient faster, and that usually is low titer, non-typed plasma that I ask for ahead of the massive transfusion protocol.
So as we mentioned, and we have people of all levels listening to this. So for that patient, that person out there that's dealing with pediatric trauma, they're sitting there looking at the kid. What is your trigger point? Say, okay, I'm going to give blood, and this is the order I'm going to put in. How are you going to order that blood?
Sure. So the pediatric patient who comes in who is hypotensive, I'm thinking about blood first, and I may give a little crystalloid in 10 to 20 cc aliquots. while waiting to get that blood in, but I'm going to go to blood very quickly. And once I start to go to blood, if I have any sense that I'm going to need more blood, that's the trigger for a massive transfusion protocol. If a pediatric patient comes in with penetrating truncal injury, that's an indication for a massive transfusion protocol. If I've reached 40 cc's per kilo of blood replacement, that's a half a blood volume for a pediatric patient. That's an indication for a massive transfusion protocol. And I'm going to start with the blood that I've got in the trauma bay. I'm going to ask for low titer plasma next. And then I'm going to give platelets once I've hit 4 aliquots of each of that plasma and the red cells.
I think the only thing we haven't touched on so far is the role for TXA in children. Can you maybe elaborate on that a little bit?
So TXA in kids has been shown to be efficacious in elective surgery, some cardiac surgery, some ear, nose, and throat surgery. The use of it has been shown to decrease blood transfusion. In our institution, we use it for burn debridement, and we use it preemptively, and it's been shown to, in our place, to decrease blood transfusion protocol. For trauma, less well studied, but there are published guidelines for the administration, the initial dosing, and the longer term dosing of TXA. So again, I think that it really should be partnered with biologic testing, such as a TEG or ROTEM, but I personally am in favor of TXA for the exsanguinating PEDS patient.
So there's a lot of people that are very comfortable with trauma, whether you're a general surgeon in the middle of, let's just say northern Wisconsin, for lack of a better place, yeah. Gominaqua, versus other people who are at, you know, high institutions. So two questions to you.
Sure.
Do you feel that, when a kid rolls through the door that's injured, all of a sudden everything changes? And so what's your advice? First of all, do you think that when applicable that there should be obviously dedicated pediatric trauma places where they just go and it's just all of that? Or can people who, and obviously people can handle it, but what are your thoughts on the dedicated places? And then the second thing is, what's your kind of your words of wisdom, a couple of high points for people who are taking trauma call, they're taking it at some of these level 2 places out there, level 3 places, and a kid rolls through the door. Because I did that for 17 years, and I can tell you that ups the ante every single time. And I knew I could take care of adults. I've been deployed 4 times. I've done it all, but a kid would roll through that door, and I'd be like, oh man, I just want to be out.
I think the big thing is to stop for just a moment, say to yourself, the principles of this resuscitation, the principles of the management of this resuscitation do not differ. If I violate the CABCs, I'm going to make a mistake.
So, Todd, aren't they just like little adults in that respect?
Well, in that respect, they are. But I show this great picture when I give a talk of my 80-year-old grandmother, my then about 32-year-old pregnant wife, and my 1-year-old. And I say, absolutely, the principles of management of all 3 of those patients are exactly the same, but each has a unique physiology and anatomy that you've got to take into account. So as I think about airway, here are the differences. As I think about circulation, here are the differences. And so it is, you have to be disciplined about that. The second thing I would say is the use of a weight-based system, a Braslow-type system. You cannot overestimate it. I resuscitate 1,500 pediatric trauma patients a year. It gets used every single time. Because if I misjudge a weight by 15%, because I'm in a hurry, I'm a little nervous, I don't see a lot of kids, and I misjudge the intubation doses, I make a huge mistake. It's got everything. It's got my doses for my meds. It's got my equipment there. There really is no substitute for that. The third thing would be bring a pharmacist to the resuscitation. They're invaluable. Making the drug errors during that, not having to worry about that, lets me focus on the CABCs.
All right, well, we're also joined by Dr. Alexander Eastman. Dr. Eastman, if you mind introducing yourself, telling us who you are, where you come from, what you do.
Sure. Thanks a lot, guys. Appreciate the opportunity to join you today. I'm Alex Eastman. I'm the medical director in chief of the Reese Jones Trauma Center, Parkland Hospital in Dallas, and a faculty surgeon at UT Southwestern. For the purposes of what I think we're going to be discussing, I'm also the lieutenant and chief medical officer of the Dallas Police Department.
So today you talked about the Hartford consensus. If you could just give us a brief high points of your talk, what the salient factors are, and just the high points.
Sure, Jason. So the idea behind the Hartford consensus is that the American College of Surgeons, the FBI, the Major City Chiefs Association, and a few other stakeholders came together after the Sandy Hook shooting to try to look at the issue of death and exsanguination after active shooter events in the United States. It's something that is I think we would all agree that there really is no reason in 2016 for someone to die a preventable death from exsanguination. We have the technology that's been proven in a number of other settings to help combat some of those injuries. That technology, the idea, the principles of hemorrhage control that were so successful at saving lives in the Middle East, really has not made the same penetrance into the civilian community. We're getting better, but we're not great. And so the Hartford Consensus was brought together to try to see if there were steps that could be taken to improve survival from the active shooter. It's come in four phases of sorts. First phase was really designed to study the problem and create a set of steps that public safety agencies could follow to maximize survival, and that's what's been codified as the THREAT acronym. The second document was designed and really to showcase the idea that what previously happened from an active shooter response standpoint in the United States is that the response occurred basically in three phases: a law enforcement phase, a fire rescue EMS phase, and a community recovery phase. To improve survival, those things have to be much more intertwined than ever before. And so the idea is not that just we couldn't just make hemorrhage control a core law enforcement skill. We had to get firefighter, rescuer, EMS personnel involved in the game much earlier, in the response much earlier than they ever had been before, and into some areas that traditionally they would have stayed out of under the guise of this is not secure enough for us to enter. As we built upon this and as it gained traction, you know, we continue to look at the problem and continue to look at these events as they occur. And it was really in Aurora and most recently at the Community College in Oregon when you saw that you know, we've told people to run, if you can't run, to hide, and if you can't hide, to fight. But really what we're seeing is that, you know, 85% of people that are the victims of an active shooter evacuate the premises immediately. But there is a percentage of people that are not wounded but stay to help their fellow wounded person. And so the idea behind the most recent two pieces of the Hartford Consensus is that this really can't be a first responder problem. It has to be an immediate responder problem. And we have to train people in who work in large occupancy buildings, stadiums, hotels, casinos, other, you know, sporting event sites, schools. We have to train and equip those people to do the things that they need to do to provide effective emergent hemorrhage control. If you imagine, it's like what CPR was in the 80s and 90s. We hope that public access hemorrhage control will be the cause that unites Americans in a healthcare front over the next decade. And we're going to try to do our best to make sure that that happens.
Alex, I'm really moved by this and want to bring it into our state in Arkansas. Where can I look for funding to try to get these resources and put them in public places and do a little bit of this training? Are there any opportunities for that?
So Todd, I would say that there are indeed opportunities, and I would say they come on a number of fronts, as you can imagine. So first and foremost, these kits are not expensive. A tourniquet, a packet of combat gauze, you're looking at less than $50. And if you buy them in bulk, significantly less than that. The other thing to say is that, look, when you're in a quest for funding, there's basically three options. You go first to, what most people do is go to federal funding. And if you're in a city like, let's say, Little Rock in your state, which is a UASI city, an Urban Area Securities Initiative city, for the first time this year, Homeland Security grant funding from the federal government, the hemorrhage control equipment is an approved expenditure. So you can expend federal Homeland Security grant money to start a bleeding control, hemorrhage control, Hartford Consensus compliant program. The second thing I would say is there are a number of local options in every jurisdiction. Some places have gone straight out of their local budget, out of tax dollars, to fund programs like this because of their importance. And the third thing, which I think is an under-tapped resource when we talk about hemorrhage control programs, is a philanthropic approach. We've certainly done this in the city of Dallas, in the state of Texas, and really in many, many areas nationally. This is a cause that people can really get behind. And just when you think that it settles down and it's out of the national consciousness, boom, there's another event to shock us back into reality. And so I think if you try one of those three, you know, federal, state, and then philanthropic funding, this is not a difficult type program to get funded. It's very easy for someone to grasp the importance.
So with full disclosure, my listeners here understand that I went to West Point, and without trying to get too political on this, let's say I'm the person that says, so you're telling me that I'm a teacher, my wife is a teacher, so she needs to learn hemorrhage control? That's going to be a standard portion? What about the person, what do you say, the people say, why don't we work on gun control instead of hemorrhage control, and where do we go from there? Again, how do you change that kind of issue there towards the reality? It is what it is. We got to do something about this cause. How do you get the focus more on the teaching and explaining in a way, and actually my question is away from the political issue, to try to get this agenda, which I think is extremely important, into place?
So Scott, I think that what you do is you depoliticize it completely. And I'll give you, we'll use your wife as an example. She's a school teacher. I mean, I guarantee you she's walking around with a CPR card in her pocket right now. But the risk of her doing CPR on one of those children is probably somewhere in the same neighborhood of the risk of her having to control hemorrhage from some act of violence in her school. It's an unfortunate fact of life for us right now. So what you do is you depoliticize it for the teacher, and you say, hey, here's a skill that you're going to potentially need to use to save the life of a child or the life of someone in your classroom or your own life in the event that an untoward event occurs. It's just like CPR. Now, what you also do is, Scott, you can't do this in a vacuum. Just because we want to focus on hemorrhage control in schools and malls and airports doesn't mean that we can't address the other things, which are the absolute epidemic of firearm violence in the United States, and the Committee on Trauma is in the process of taking a very, very hard look at that. And you cannot even begin to discuss this topic, and it's not even something that we should get into today, but until you address the deficiencies in the mental health care system in the United States, you absolutely can't take a really scientific look at this problem, because all those are component pieces.
The other thing I might suggest is not to make this only an issue around gun violence, because actually in our state, we did this work with our game and fish people, because they were often the first people on scene for a boating accident or a hunting accident or something or some other event that led to life-threatening hemorrhage. And so there are plenty of opportunities to prevent mortality, and I think it's useful anytime.
Well, and Todd, that's a great point, and I think you'll notice as the fourth Hartford Consensus document really gets out into the mainstream that it's not a move away from the active shooter and the high-threat medicine concept, but it does take into account that you may learn these skills because you're preparing your institution for an active shooter response, but they're awfully handy at home when your, you know, young child, I've got a young boy, you know, does one of his classic donkey moves and dives into the, you know, curb or whatever. Same hemorrhage control techniques work there as they do when you're under threat.
Yeah, it's really, just listening to you guys talk, it's really quite amazing that, thinking back, I mean, what's the number one lifesaver on the battlefield? It's the tourniquet for hemorrhage control. And it's amazing that, you know, you're right. Everybody learns CPR, but this has been a problem, and we've known this for decades.
But so, Jason, we've got a West Point graduate, the chief of an EMS system in Arkansas, a Dallas police lieutenant on our SWAT team, all in the same room. We absolutely agree. But as you saw just as recently as 48 hours ago, if you go back to that big room over there, there's still guys in our business with gray hair that think that you apply a tourniquet, you have limb loss immediately. And so it's unbelievable to me that we come to a meeting of, you know, people who are clearly at the cutting edge of trauma in the United States. I mean, these are the guys that are out there doing it. This is the workforce. And you're still fighting 50-year-old misconceptions about the use of extremity tourniquets. So I come to this every year, and I go home re-energized by the fact that there is a ton of work left to do.
So what kind of techniques are being taught then to you know, the school teachers?
Yeah, so I think if you look at the bleeding control course, which is the National Association of EMTs hemorrhage control training course for the general population, It's a pretty rudimentary system. I mean, it's pressure bandaging, it's wound packing, and it's tourniquet application. And it's very simple. This is not this is not intended to make Mrs. Myers, my first grade teacher, it's not intended to turn her into Dr. Myers, right? It's to give her the rudimentary skills and the specialized equipment that she needs to be an effective hemorrhage control expert.
So, gentlemen, thanks so much for taking the time out to join us on BTK. We always like to end these with just little one-liners, little Mad Libs fill in the blank. So you all three come from very different backgrounds and kind of in your present situation. So, Alex, we'll start with you. So I'd ask each of you to fill in the blank. What was one thing that you really took away? Maybe it's new. Maybe it's something that you just kind of remembered again from this conference here.
I would say the one thing I took away from this conference so far is that we can absolutely be far more aggressive in our chemoprophylaxis for VTE in patients with head injuries that are more severe than we've ever treated before.
Andrew?
I think I got the most so far out of your talks. Scott, one, tips and tricks on the tough stoma, and two, you didn't give me an answer on complicated diverticulitis because you told me every patient situation is going to be a little different and you have to use your judgment. So you affirmed for me that my patient-by-patient approach to managing diverticulitis is okay, and that I don't need to be managing everyone a certain particular way, like some authors or some experts might suggest.
Todd? And I think actually I learned the most from your talk. I learned that I've gotten comfortable with my postoperative pain management prescription, and I need to broaden that with other drugs and other medications. I need to start with non-opioid first and think about not escalating with opioids as if the initial dose is inadequate. So I learned a lot.
Those are great points. Well, everyone, thanks for taking the time to join us after your panel discussion, or excuse me, after your last talk. And we hope this gets you back and behind a knife in the future. So
would love it. Thanks for the offer.
Well, that does it for us today at Behind the Knife. We hope you enjoyed all the great talks at the Trauma, Critical Care, Acute Care Surgery Conference. We certainly had a blast being here, and we're hoping to be back next year.
Until next time, dominate the day.